before your listeners go to bed tonight, there will be 4 more people in this country will have died as a direct result of alcohol harm. And I think that that's something that we don't think about enough, that we don't talk about enough, and that we don't make real.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the HSE Talking Health and Wellbeing podcast. My name is Noreen Turley, and today we're talking about Alcohol Forum Ireland. We're joined by the CEO of Alcohol Forum Ireland, Paula Leonard. Thank you very much for joining us today. So Paula, Alcohol Forum Ireland is a charity, but what exactly does it do? Where did you come from? What's your objectives? If you can just put that all into a nutshell for me.
Thanks a million. I suppose, first of all, I want to say congratulations on the podcast because I think it's a really important way of reaching new people and new audiences and having wider conversations on topics related to health. So well done to all the team. But in relation to our own organization, we're slightly older than your podcast. We celebrate 15 years of doing what we do this year. So we're quite a mature organization in that sense. And really how Alcohol Forum came about from very humble and small beginnings was a direct response to the issue of what's now known, but wasn't then known as as hidden harm, and looking at hidden harm and the impact that parental alcohol use, parental alcohol misuse, and parents who are in active addiction and the impact that that's having on family, it's having on family life. It's having on those parents themselves who require support often and intervention, and on children. And I suppose we started out as very much a small Donegal-based organisation where the health service, as it was then, the Northwestern Health Board, TUSLA didn't exist. The hidden harm strategy didn't exist. But there was a lot of good support and a real belief that actually health couldn't do this on its own. We needed to work with the guards, we needed to work with media, we needed to work with social work services, we needed to work with communities, we needed to work with domestic violence services, and we needed to bring all of those people together to have a conversation around the complexity of when alcohol use and other drug use is an issue in the home and for parents in particular. So what we did at the time was the organisation looked at the number of referrals really that were happening to child protection services in particular, and Donegal had a disproportionate number of those where alcohol was been cited in about 1 in every 3 cases as the primary reason why families were being referred on to child protection services. And there was a feeling in the county that we could do this better, that we could go back up the stream and we could say, well, what does prevention look like? What support do those parents need? So rather than taking children into the care of the state, that what we could and should do was look at intervening early, providing supports earlier, and seeing what supports families needed, looking at the strengths, actually, that families already have, and what could happen around that. And from those, I suppose, early days and those humble beginnings, the organisation grew to become sort of Donegal, Sligo, Leitrim, and became the Northwest Alcohol Forum as it was. And then numbers of years ago, we also opened our 3rd office in Cavan, Monaghan, where we now are looking at, you know, what are the support needs of families there? What are the support needs of children there? And we also have an under 18s alcohol and drug service there. So it would be similar to Yoda and to Sassy. And really, I suppose what we've always done is we've always worked from the bottom up because we believe that families, that individuals and that communities actually hold the key to solving their own problems. And that when you work with them and you work at that grassroots level and when you use your listening ears and you understand what families are going through and how they see the solutions. So what solutions could they come up with? And really, I suppose, from there, we were also involved in community action on alcohol long before, I suppose, the term was even recognized in international policy terms. And community action on alcohol is actually very much recognized at a global level as one of the strongest things that you can do if you want to reduce the levels of alcohol harm within a population. And that's something that Ireland needs to do. Because before your listeners go to bed tonight, there'll be 4 more people in this country will have died as a direct result of alcohol harm. And I think that that's something that we don't think about enough, that we don't talk about enough, and that we don't make real. So as I was driving in this morning, I was listening again to the need for more resources to tackle the very worrying rise in the number of road traffic accidents and road deaths and catastrophic injuries on our roads in Ireland. But we hear all the time about the stories and the lived lives of the people who have, you know, lost their lives in those accidents. And we don't tell the stories enough of the people who have died as a result of alcohol harm. So, for example, even here at the county level where we deliver an alcohol-related brain injury service, we have had numbers of people die since the beginning of this year. Young parents who have left small children behind, you know, individuals who are at an end stage with an alcohol-related brain injury and are very, very ill. We're not hearing those stories. We're not talking about those lives in the same way. We're not celebrating those people after, you know, they've been buried. We're not being honest and real with ourselves about the toll that that's taking on our lives here in Ireland. And, you know, for us, I suppose, making visible that and talking about that, supporting families, supporting communities, supporting individuals, one, to have a chance of recovery and a better family life, and two, to actually become active agents for change, to become meaningfully engaged in building a safer Ireland and building a safer community. And that's really what we're about in a nutshell, Noreen, if that makes sense.
That's great, Paula. That really outlines. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about, what does that look like on a daily basis? Like, what does your organisation provide to the people on the ground with that acquired brain injury, or those children that you're speaking about, or those families? Like, somebody has an issue, where do they start? What do you give them? What process do you follow?
Yeah, so what that looks like is it looks a little bit different on different levels. So our Community Action on Alcohol program is a national program which could not survive, does not have the resources, the expertise, or the links to communities if we didn't have the support of those regional and local drug and alcohol task forces across the country who really lead the way and have the expertise about their own communities and what would work in their own communities. So we have a national lead for Community Action on Alcohol, just one resource, very stretched. She's extremely flexible. And she provides that level of support to the communities that lead the way on that. And we have very exciting, a new national initiative that is the first of its kind in Europe, that is taking the World Health Organization's safer package of alcohol policy measures. And I can talk about that a little later. But it's testing those out, rolling those out with the support of the Department of Health and with the support of an academic partner that will soon be appointed. We will be evaluating that process over the next 3 years and standardizing a model of community-based action on alcohol that works, that's evidence-based. If we get to the end of the evaluation and there's things that didn't work, we'll have to have a look at that too. And so that's the Community Action on Alcohol piece. It does an awful lot of work around the alcohol industry, the Irish Community Action on Alcohol Network, policy and advocacy. Their big ticket item at the moment is looking to have changes made to the Sale of Alcohol Bill, or now it's been called the Intoxicating Liquor Act of 2024. So that's that piece. But then up here in what in HSE terms is called CHO1. So we work at the service level across Sligo, Leitrim, Donegal, Cavan and Monaghan. And in those areas, we provide a range of evidence-based supports. And I say evidence-based, and some people don't understand that. Maybe your listeners, it sounds jargony. But really what that means is that we are absolutely assured that the programs and the interventions that we spend staff time on work, that they've been tried, they've been tested, they've been evaluated. We take feedback from everyone who comes through those programs. And really, it's just a very short way of saying we know what works and we use what works. So in that package of programs, we deliver an impact program, which is MPACT, which is moving parents and children together. And we know across the addiction field, there's not enough focus on the participation of children, the voices of children, the needs of children and the rights of children to be supported too. deal with the issues and deal with the frustrations and the breakdown in communication. And sometimes they're cast into the role of parents and really impact as long as the child is seven. And seven is about being able to talk and speak. Now, we do use art forms and art therapy in the program as well, but it's about them being able to say what life is like for them when mommy or daddy or, you know, whatever other caregiver might be the important person in their life is struggling with alcohol or other drugs. And over, you know, the period of 8 weeks, and there's an assessment beforehand, or there's follow-up after, and there's family reunion happens after, but they go through a process of really listening to the child's story and the child's journey. And parents are often very surprised because they think they've managed to hide their drinking or their other drug taking from the child. They think that they've protected them. They haven't discussed it. They've never been honest emotionally. There's lots of good things happening in those families, but the addiction piece is really impacting on sort of parental authority, who's in charge in the house, the level of fear and stress and anxiety that those wee kids have in relation to. We've had children sit on that program and say, you know, mommy, when you go out in the car at night to get your cans, I'm always really worried that you're never going to come home. And that's really hard for mommy to hear because she doesn't know that that child knows that she's intoxicated when she drives down to the off license a number of miles away or when she gets drink deliveries. And that child is a genuine worry that needs to be heard. And that process of allowing space for the child's voice can be absolutely transformative within that program.
And Paula, I don't think we give young people and children, I don't think we realise how much they do actually know within the four walls of their own home and how much they observe and how much they kind of take in. And if somebody wants to, if a child needs support, that first contact has to be made by the parent, though, does it, or the caregiver? So what if that person is the one that has the alcohol problem? You know, how does that work? And if they're not ready to face that, and
interestingly, you know, we have delivered impact in all sorts of complex situations. We take referrals from TUSLA. We've taken referrals from the CAMS service. We've taken them from the Gardaí. We've had self-referral where people have heard about it. We've even had people come back a number of years later and saying, we really need to do this again. You know, it worked for us, but there's been a couple of big picture things have happened in our families and we'd like to come back and refresh our learning and have those conversations supported by skilled practitioners. So self-referral is an option, but it doesn't happen a lot. So generally speaking, it's, you know, a social worker or some service that's involved with the family will say, look, would you be willing to try this out? Would you sit down together? Would you come and have a chat with one of our skilled practitioners who'll go out and sit with you either in your home or meet you somewhere else, or you can come on into one of our three offices. We'll sit and we'll chat about it and we'll see if this might be a good match. And you're absolutely right that we don't credit enough what children see and know and how they can be really part of the solution. So for example, we've had children when we've asked them, well, what do you need, you know, in your situation? We have had quite small children say, I want to learn how to do CPR. I want to know how, if mommy has passed out or daddy has passed out, I want to know how to ring an ambulance. So some of the things that they want are very straightforward, skill-based things. So at another level, we might be thinking they need psychological support or they need to have talk therapies or something. And what they're saying is actually, in the reality of my life, I need to feel safe and I need to be able to act if I need to act. And these are the things that I would need to do. And those can be really transformative conversations for adults to hear and to recognize and to begin to, you know, move towards recovery or move towards sort of accessing, you know, addiction services. What we have found, and IMPACT's been run for 20 years in the UK really successfully. So there's a lot of evidence. It's run in prisons. It's now run in schools. It's run in a lot of places. But what they have found actually is that because it's fairly unique, you don't have to be in recovery and you don't have to be in treatment to come to the program. You only have to be sober on the night of the program. That's it. That's all that's been asked of you. So it's not, it's different to an awful lot of other things that are offered to people. And what we do find, and the evidence and years of research in the UK would suggest, it actually moves people towards seeking support for their own addiction. It moves people towards recovery. It moves people towards very significant changes in their lives.
Okay.
And that's really what we're in the business of. So that's one of our programs.
Yeah.
I've gone on a little bit about
it. No, that's okay, because I think that's got a huge impact, obviously, on families. And you're meeting the person at where they're at, maybe with their addiction, and you're giving them the opportunity. But the other thing that you mentioned earlier was that you're very much focused on raising awareness of the impact that alcohol has on brain health. So tell us a little bit about that program that you have.
Yeah, so we have what's called, you know, in an operational plan speak, we have a life sort of course approach to brain health, because we have run an alcohol-related brain injury service, a community-based service that supports rehabilitation and recovery for people who've acquired a brain injury as a result of their consuming alcohol over a long period of time. But when you really started to look at it, we thought, well, it's not just in adulthood that alcohol impacts the brain. It actually starts before we're born. So Ireland has, you know, often been cited in international research as being the third country with the highest levels of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder in the world. So this year, there will be 1 million babies born across the globe who will have a lifelong preventable intellectual disability as a result of being exposed to alcohol during pregnancy. Okay, so I really feel, and as an organization, we really feel, women in particular need to be armed with the information. They need to know and they need to be told, in the same way that we know about folic acid, we know about iron during pregnancy. It needs to be in that suite of sort of things that we know when we're hoping to bring new life into the world, that really for pregnancy, no alcohol is the safest option. It's absolutely the safest option. And it's the only way that we can absolutely guarantee pregnancy that doesn't have a risk of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. So if women don't know, we can't have a blaming approach or a finger wagging approach. And there's very low level population awareness of the fact that any amount of alcohol during pregnancy carries a risk with it. So we look at that, and we look at, you know, sort of prevention messages, and very much working with the HSE. And the HSE alcohol program have really stepped up in terms of thinking about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, preventing fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. A big challenge was getting the Irish medical profession to agree one cohesive, straightforward, unequivocal message. And that message is no level of alcohol consumption in pregnancy is safe. That took a while. They now have a lovely plan. So, you know, there is more awareness. So that's that piece. The other piece then, because we've been involved in services and supports to teenagers, at a project level, we're very interested in raising awareness of the impact that alcohol has on the developing teenage brain. And our brain is actually the last organ of the body to develop fully. And over the last 10 years, neuroscience has really developed its understanding of the fact that the human brain in women probably doesn't fully develop until about our mid-20s. And for some, for men, it can be a lot later. It can be up to 30 years of age. So if we want to protect the development of our frontal lobe, which is good decision-making, deciding on a mortgage, buying a car, all those big life decisions, making a decision about who I might spend my life with as a partner, all of those things that we do in adulthood that might be a little bit boring, but the brain develops the ability to be able to make those decisions, to assess risk, to understand what's good for us. And we don't settle into that until our mid-20s. So the best thing that we can be doing is protecting that brain from the neurotoxic properties of alcohol. And what neurotoxic properties of alcohol basically means is that alcohol is a toxic substance for our brain. It can derail brain development. It can delay brain development. It can, you know, using alcohol during our teenage years significantly increases our likelihood of developing an addiction, not just to alcohol, but to any other substance during our adulthood. So if we want as parents to protect the development of our teenagers' brains, we really should be talking about rule setting. We should be talking about knowing where our kids are and who they're with and what they're up to, and setting really clear guidelines and boundaries for kids. Because as teenagers, it's your job to push the line. And as parents, unfortunately, it's your job to hold the line. You know, as I say to my wee one all the time, it's not my job to be your friend. You know, it's not my job. Unfortunately, 90% of the time we can act like buddies, but it is my job to make decisions that you aren't ready to make yet.
Yeah.
And I think parents don't know that. We've had a very moralistic approach over a long period of time in relation to teenagers and alcohol consumption. We've sort of, you know, vilified young people for drinking, and aren't they awful and irresponsible? And it's not about that at all. It's about saying to teenagers, guess what, folks? This isn't a good thing for your brain development. Yeah.
And you know, Paula, we have done just, you mentioned alcohol and during pregnancy, we have done a podcast on alcohol and pregnancy. And we've also done a couple on addiction and young people and parental support and that type of thing. So that is a common theme that is coming out. It's giving people the information and making them aware of that. And that's obviously that's the business.
Yeah, that's our key message, because, you know, whether it's during pregnancy or it's during the teenage years, and now I'll come to talking about sort of the impact it has on the adult brain. I suppose if your listeners were to take anything from it, it's just to acknowledge that alcohol is a neurotoxin. There is no amount of alcohol that we drink, none, that doesn't have an impact on the function or the structure of our brain. So the function of our brain, how we assess risk, how we think, you know, how sad we feel, all of those things it impacts. But use over a long period of time has an impact on the structure of our brain. And what we are seeing now is, you know, years ago, if you were to ask any sort of medical practitioner, what would a typical presentation look like for an alcohol-related brain injury? Korsakoff's or Wernicke's encephalopathy or any of those. Largely, they would have in their heads, the stereotype that they would have been an older man. And that was to do with sort of patterns of drinking. Unfortunately, our service is now seeing women in their 40s, men in their 40s, and sometimes in their 30s who have drank, you know, at significant levels over long periods of time, over years, and they have developed a brain injury. So cognitively, they're having issues with short-term memory. They're having issues where their cerebellum is affected. They're having balance issues, mobility issues, and those issues are spilling out into other areas of their lives.
And what do you provide for those people, Paula?
We have rehabilitation and recovery service. And Noreen, for most of our work, we would sort of be saying to people, it's about harm reduction and it's about, you know, reducing your intake or thinking about your intake. But when it comes to alcohol-related brain injury, the model really is, in the first instance, abstinence. Because if we can achieve abstinence with the client, their brain does have a chance to recover.
So you help them, you try and help them in a program to achieve abstinence.
Absolutely. Okay. And we work with addiction services. But really beyond that, and we have to really start to think about this, nutrition is absolutely key. Okay. Vitamin B1 is absolutely key. Physical activity, you know, those psychosocial interventions, rebuilding and looking at family support. Often when our clients come to us, the relationships with other family members have completely broken down because of the chaos around the drinking that has happened over years. So it is a sort of a bespoke program, but it delivers a range of interventions that are sort of designed around the needs of the client. But you can see in neurological terms, clients with an alcohol-related brain injury can do really well, actually. Yeah. And over 10 years, about a quarter of all of the clients who've come through our rehabilitation service have fully recovered.
Yeah, the brain is an amazing organ, though. It's amazing. The way it can kind of reroute itself and everything. So I know that you're based in Donegal, but if people want to access a program like this around the country, can they access something like you provide?
Unfortunately, no.
Okay.
You know, our community-based rehabilitation and recovery program is unique, and we have had the support of mental health services and the HSE in Donegal over numbers of years to do that. What we would be doing now in terms of our strategic plan is looking at spreading and sharing those stories of success.
Great. Yeah.
And of looking for similar responses. In the whole of Ireland, there's only one residential unit for people with an alcohol-related brain injury, and that's in Belfast. So a group of our own board and staff, including myself, are going up in June to have a look at that and spend a day and looking at the interventions, the supports, the therapies. Like, physio and occupational are very important in the recovery and rehabilitation of people with an alcohol-related brain injury. Really important. And in fact, OTs are very much part of the team in Belfast. We would love to see some sort of a residential facility like that somewhere in the Republic of Ireland that could take referrals from across the country.
And I'm sure you'd love to see this programme that you offer rolled out in other communities around the country. So
absolutely. What we have is a very limited resource. These are very complex cases. They're very challenging cases to work with. They require support from a range of professionals. We try and pull all of that together. But, you know, again, coming back to acknowledging, there was always an acknowledgement, and I know colleagues in the Western Regional Drug and Alcohol Task Force are developing some work around alcohol-related brain injury and some education for professionals around alcohol-related brain injury. Along the Western Seaboard, there's always been an acknowledgement that we have a higher than the national prevalence in terms of alcohol-related brain injury. Why? Answering that question would probably take much longer than one podcast on its own. But our patterns of drinking, our presentations to services, alcohol has always been sort of the primary drug of choice in this region. And we need to talk about that and we need to respond to that. But if anyone is listening in philanthropic terms or directors of services that have some money down the back of the couch, you know, our strategic vision, our strategic vision in the long term is that we would have something similar to the residential unit in Belfast and that we would be able to provide on-site supports through a multidisciplinary team for people with an alcohol-related brain injury. We know it works. It's working in Scotland. It saves millions, actually, to health services because you're able to take people who otherwise are inappropriately put in nursing homes.
Yeah.
I reckon about 10% of dementias may not be dementias. They may be misdiagnosed or underdiagnosed alcohol-related brain injury. Those people have a right to a recovery. They have a right to, you know, proper diagnostics. And they also have a chance of living a fully independent life.
Yeah. Well, look, Paula, good luck with your visit in June. And it'll be interesting to see what happens with that one. The other thing I wanted to talk to you about was the Irish Community Action and Alcohol Network. And is that the IMARC? So maybe you can clarify for me exactly what that is.
Yeah, I suppose back when the regional local drug and alcohol task force were given responsibility around alcohol. So they were always illicit drugs only since the 1980s. And for very good reason, they had grown up from a community call that government and agencies would be taking seriously sort of the heroin epidemics that largely were happening in Dublin in sort of the 1980s. So drug and alcohol task forces have a very grassroots history. And in 2015, the Department of Health made a decision that they would add alcohol to the brief of local drug and alcohol task forces. So before that, they were just drug task forces. And with that, our organisation was worked with the Department of Health to introduce a pilot project around community action and alcohol. And when I joined as National Lead for Community Action and Alcohol in 2016, we were delivering sort of a national training program. What is community action alcohol? What's alcohol policy? How do you tackle it? Why is it different to illicit drugs? You know, because it's the drug that we pay tax on. What does that mean? Why can you market it so widely? Why is it different? Why does it look different, feel different in terms of policy? And really, the drug and alcohol task forces that were on that national training program that year very quickly came to the conclusion, yes, we can do locally based community action and alcohol, but a lot of the things that are driving alcohol harm are bigger than our communities. They're bigger than us. They're to do with the law, they're to do with the policy, they're to do with the marketing, they're to do with the cost of alcohol, all those things. And so right down from the grassroots up came decision to form the Irish Community Action and Alcohol Network. And that network has gone from strength to strength and has done lots of things. Like, it initiated a county alcohol profiling project so that people had more local data. It has produced a report on fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. It last year, you know, was involved in launching our newest report on fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. It has done three now expert reports on sale of alcohol bill. They're a very active network. But in about 2022, in the middle of a pandemic, we had our so what moment, because communities had this understanding that the alcohol industry was interfering in our schools. They were interfering in our communities. They were looking for seats in some instances on local community organizations. They had become, Drink Aware had become a registered charity. So it was legitimately presenting itself as, you know, the national voice on reducing alcohol harm. All of those things were happening. And we got an invitation to come to the launch of a report by Drink Aware.
Sorry to interrupt you there, Paula, but maybe just explain to our listeners who Drink Aware are.
Absolutely. So Drink Aware are an alcohol industry funded charity. Okay. So they are basically funded.
That sounds 100%. Like a little bit of a conflict.
It is. It's oxymoronic when you start to think about it, because we wouldn't have the tobacco industry in teaching our children how to smoke safely. Wouldn't happen.
No, I
hope not. People would just find it absolutely insane. We do now have the gambling industry, though, going in to do some gambling awareness in schools, and that needs to be stopped. But back in 2022, we thought, are you joking me? We've been invited to the launch of a drinks industry funded program in our schools. And at that stage, thousands, I think 15,000 school students in Ireland had been through their training program. Parents had never been asked permission. Parents had never seen the documentation. It turned out that the Department of Education had never seen the program. Turned out that the HSE had never seen the program. Government had never seen the program.
So were they just having direct access to schools?
They were given direct access to schools, and they provided teacher training. And that really was sort of our so what moment. And we thought, you know what? There's got to be something that we can do about this. They're bigger than us. They are part of, you know, a global corporate power. But what can we do in communities? And what we decided we could do in communities was we could start to talk about it. We could start to think about it. We could develop a beautiful brand that we're very proud of that is called the I-Mark. And the I-Mark, the I stands for independence. And it's the mark of independence that your community group, your charity, your youth work organization understands that the alcohol industry shouldn't be interfering in, you know, community voluntary charity sector, in the education sector, in the health sector, that they shouldn't be lobbying government in relation to alcohol policy, that it's not their business. Their business is to make profit. They're good at it. They should stay in their lane and do that. And so we developed the I-Mark, and really it was a do-it-yourself DIY way of challenging the power and the might of the alcohol industry and seeing if we could make a bit of a dent. And, you know, today we have over 40 networks and organizations in Ireland that are part of the IMARC movement. We are always welcoming and welcome new IMARC members. And it's very simple, actually. If you sign up and you adopt the IMARC and you make it visible on your website and on your email banners and in your organization and on your wall, what you're committing to is that you will not use any materials that have been developed by the industry or developed by a charity funded by the industry. You will not share a stage with them. You will not see them as legitimate part of any initiative to reduce alcohol harm, because the overwhelming evidence is that this is not benign. This is a corrosive impact on our health and our well-being. And you will not accept funding from them. And that you will consider seriously a series of questions that we have very nicely put together that allows you to think about, well, where is this going to show up? If we take their money, are they going to have it in their annual report? Are they going to use it for a halo effect? Are they going to say, well, actually, we're funding these communities. to reduce alcohol harm. So therefore, you as government don't need to worry about regulating us. You don't need to worry about a watershed around alcohol advertising. We've got it covered. You know, don't panic. Alcohol consumption's coming down. Teenage consumption's coming down. Don't worry about it. We have it sorted. So really, it was about a grassroots movement, understanding, educating ourselves, having conversations in small organizations and big. Like the very first group signed up were a local youth organization in Letterkenny. And they're a small organization, very active, but they had turned down funding for an obesity project from Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
And they had said,
same thing. Yeah.
No,
yeah.
That industry has no interest in reducing obesity rates in the planet. So for them, this made very logical sense that this be the next thing they're doing. We have the Dublin Public Participation Network. They've over 400 organizations or members. They've signed up. Right. So lots of groups are signing up because it's beginning to make sense.
And Paula, how would our listeners, how can they sign up?
Very simple. They contact us at info@alcoholforum.org. And you simply say you want to find out more about the IMARC, or you can go on our website and find out. We will then organise very short 10-minute presentation on the 6 key strategies of the alcohol industry, and any of our members who've done their champions training could deliver that to their board. The one thing we do insist on is that for a charity, community, voluntary organisation, it needs to be signed up to at board level.
Okay.
So we have that whole organisation approach. Everybody has been involved in the conversation. Everybody's consciousness is raised. Everybody understands why the alcohol industry is a threat to our health, to our well-being, and to our children, and to our policy. People get the chance to understand that, to question it, to ask about it. Then you sign a little form. And then 1 year after that, you sign a little form again to say, we are still on board. We want to renew our membership. We're still part of it. And then we run campaigns. We ran a campaign to have schools-based education free from alcohol industry influence. That was a very active campaign over a short period of time where we were involved in parliamentary questions. There were parliamentary debates. The Taoiseach was doorstepped by a national journalist. We were on Morning Ireland. We were in head-to-heads in relation to the CEO of Drink Aware on the radio. It was being raised everywhere. It was being discussed widely, and that was new.
Yeah, that was a great success, and, really, Paula.
Yeah, and the HSE stepped up, and the Department of Health and the Department of Education stepped up and said, that's the end of it. They're out of our schools.
Very good.
And that was great. And we now have a Dirty Little Secrets campaign that's looking at the strategy of the alcohol industry in denying or confusing the information that particularly is going out to women in relation to the link between alcohol and 7 types of cancer, but mostly that confusion or denial of the link between alcohol and breast cancer. Yeah. So within Europe, they would suggest that 1 in every 10 breast cancers is related to alcohol. In Ireland, unfortunately, because of our patterns of consumption, the reports that have been published would suggest that it's 1 in 8 breast cancers. And if women, again, don't know that, if they're not empowered to understand, if they're not given the information, if they somehow blindly trust the false information that the industry is peddling, then there's work that we need to do around empowering people. And there's no finger wagging in it.
I know, Paula. And the thing is about the impact that alcohol has and the relationship with cancer is definitely something that I've realized over the last couple of years is not known out there. It's not common knowledge. And you're equipping people again in all of these areas with that knowledge. And I'm sure that the SAFER program, I mean, you're doing quite a lot now, Paula, from humble beginnings, as you say, but you have the SAFER, because we probably could talk for ages, but we probably need to, before we come to a close, I just want to give you an opportunity to talk about the SAFER program, because you mentioned that at the outset.
Yeah, so back in 2019, the World Health Organization did a review. So they brought together a number of global experts, including Professor Tom Baber, and I mention him for a reason, I'll come back. But he was one of the global experts that the WHO said, could you do a piece of work for us? Could you look at the last 30 years of evidence and research on alcohol? And could you come back and tell us what are the biggest things that work? So if a country, a government, you know, or a region, like say for the EU region, if they wanted to really make a dent, save lives and reduce alcohol harm, what are the things that they would do? So Tom and his team of experts went off and they did, you know, this big review of all of the evidence over 30 years. And they came back and said, well, there's five key things that you'd do. You'd look at the price of alcohol, the availability of alcohol. You'd look at drink driving countermeasures. You'd look at screening and brief intervention. So here in Ireland, we have the MEC and we have the SARE programmes led out and by the HSE.
And so let's and just for that, our listeners, sorry to interrupt you again, Paula, but just for our listeners, we'll just call out. So MEC is making every contact count.
Yeah.
And then the other, what did you mention that after that?
The SARE is the screening and onward referral.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the HSE have a really good screening and brief intervention. And what we know is that screening and brief intervention works. There's this false narrative that if you want to change your drinking or you want to improve your health or your mental health, that you need to sit and wait until you hit this rock bottom that never comes. But actually, if you have an opportunity to sit with your GP or a practice nurse or any health practitioner that you come across or somebody who works in your regional drug and alcohol task force, if you want to sit down with them and have a conversation about your alcohol consumption, screening and brief intervention will give you some real feedback around, yeah, okay, we would suggest that you probably need to enter a program. You probably need to think about this. You could cut back. It'll give you some live feedback. And if you need to be referred on, it'll refer you on. It works at a population level. So the review by the WHO said screen and brief intervention works, drink driving countermeasure works, looking at the price of alcohol, the availability of alcohol, the marketing of alcohol. These are all things that work. And they packaged them up into one package called SAFER. And all of those were robustly evaluated and very much picked because of the impact that they were having and the effectiveness. And when we were looking at our community action alcohol that we've been delivering for years, we decided, well, why not do SAFER in communities? Why not test it at a community level? That has never been done anywhere in Europe. Okay. And in fact, there are two projects now happening in the world where we're testing it. One here in Ireland, our SAFER project, and the other place that the WHO is supporting it is in Uganda. So two very different environments. They're both being evaluated over the next number of years. We do have links with the people who are evaluating it and delivering it and leading out on it in Uganda, including a wonderful member of the parliament there, Sarah Opendi, who has taken on the alcohol industry in a very strong, forthright way. And it's wonderful to see that leadership happening in a country that has many, many, many other issues and low life expectancy. So for us, it's very different here. But what we're doing, and the Minister Hildegard Nocton launched the project for us recently in 12 communities across Ireland.
Great.
Over the next 3 years, we will implement the five SAFER policy measures. We will do 15 things to implement those. We have an academic partner will be appointed so that we're not evaluating ourselves and saying, oh, it's great. So that we have somebody critically looking at it. What's the baseline in those communities? Where are those communities going to be in 3 years? We're setting up at the moment the local steering groups. So the task forces are doing that. They're setting up steering groups, and those steering groups on them will have local authorities, the police, they'll have the HSE, they'll have their youth work people, they'll have local community reps. We hope it'll have people in recovery talking about what a safer community and environment could look like for them. All of those are being set up at the moment. 12 local launches are happening. It's a really ambitious programme because the 12 communities have a combined population of almost 500,000 people.
That's great, Paula. And this is the way that you're charity is rolling out all of these things across the country. So even though these are across the country now, they're not just in Donegal and Cavan.
Oh yeah, no.
These we are have across the country.
Our most southern partners are Listowel in County Kerry and Cork City, north of Cork City. We have Ballymun, we have Swords, we have Balbriggan, we have Drogheda.
So very diverse communities there as well, Paula. Yeah.
Yeah,
Paula,
very.
Just before we finish up, I just wanted to ask you, for I suppose at the end of the day, what we're here is just to try and tell people how to access supports as well. And what would you recommend maybe for an individual who may be struggling with alcohol dependency or addiction at the moment? Where would they go either to get help for their loved ones or for themselves? What would you say to them if they're listening and they think, or there's somebody that you know has a problem, what would you say to them?
Yeah, and I think this is about recognising that Alcohol Forum Ireland is only part of a much bigger response in this country to reducing alcohol and other drug harm. I would say a number of things. One, talk to your GP. That's your first port of call for anything.
Yeah.
And your GP should be able to talk to you about whether or not you need support or that other person. They will talk to you about your partner, your loved one, your husband as well. The other thing is there's two things. The HSE Ask About Alcohol website is a great resource, and the HSE Service Finder. You can ring the helpline as well. I think all of those are really brilliant things. Regional drug and alcohol task forces, there's one in every area of the country. They mostly have, you know, an education prevention or information officer. Ring them because they will know about programs like, say, our Impact Program or Strengthening Families Program or what family supports. They'll know what's available at that local level.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really useful thing. Drop us an email or phone us. Email's probably easiest. It's info@alcoholforum.org because we would always refer people on. This is your query. This is the area you're in. Here's the person you might talk to about this. If we can't answer it ourselves, we, as sure as God, will put you in touch with the right person. The big message, I suppose, is for us, and I talked to our family support workers about this. I was saying, what would be your one big message for the HSE podcast listeners? And they were saying, for family members to understand two things. No, three things, actually. One, that help is out there for family members, not just for the person who's in active addiction. So for the mother, the brother, the father, you know, the son and the daughter, the grandchild, any of those, right? So that, first of all, help exists and that is out there. Secondly, that they have a right to access it. And thirdly, that it works. That family support as an intervention works. It can work for you in terms of transforming how you understand addiction, how you understand what's going on for that person, how you feel about that, how you manage your own boundaries. But it can also work in terms of supporting your loved one to go on and look for the help that they need. So they were their three messages.
I think they're three fantastic messages for our listeners, Paula. I think to know that this help exists and that it works and there is help out there and to please look for help, I think are really, really important messages. So I'd like to thank Paula for joining me today to talk about this really important subject. And to all our listeners, thank you for your continued support. And please share this episode if you think that somebody needs assistance with their alcohol consumption. If you'd like more information about HSE Health and Wellbeing, follow us on Twitter, X, take a look at our HSE Health and Wellbeing YouTube channel, or register for our e-zine by emailing healthandwellbeing.communications@hse.ie. This has been the HSE Talking Health and Wellbeing podcast. Thank you for listening.